ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the early 20th century, a wave of women artists left a conservative Australia to pursue new lives, new freedoms, and the radical ideas that were transforming art around the world. Hi, I'm Rosa Allen, this is The Art Show, and over the next 3 weeks on Radio National, I'm presenting a series called Dangerously Modern, made with the Art Gallery of South Australia.
They were described as dangerously modern, but the real risk these artists faced was being dangerously forgotten.
From Bendigo, Adelaide and Sydney, to the salons and art schools of London, Paris and the coast of Ireland, Dangerously Modern is an exhibition, a book and now a podcast, uncovering the stories of Australian artists who defied society's expectations, knowing a brilliant career was within reach.
My name is Tracy Locke and I'm curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of South Australia and one of the co-curators of Dangerously Modern, Australian Women Artists in Europe, 1890 to 1940. Dangerously Modern focuses on the first wave of a hugely talented cohort of Australian women artists who travelled to Europe at the turn of the 20th century.
Women like Ola Cohn, who went searching for a new kind of sculpture and found it studying with Henry Moore. Or Justine Kong Singh, the daughter of a Hong Kong merchant who arrived in London to be a professional painter at the age of 43. And Dorrit Black, who embraced Cubism and opened her own modern art centre in Sydney.
When a lot of these women artists returned to Australia, they were among the most skilled, the most highly educated artists working in the nation.
But to the leading art historian of the day, at least, they were messenger girls of a European art scene.
The Dangerously Modern project aims to show how these women were actually active participants in the transmission of modernism around the world.
Featuring 50 women artists, many of whom you wouldn't have seen or I'm going to venture heard of, who took part in the biggest shift in art and culture, away from tradition and into the modern world. But to tell this story, we're starting with one artist you very likely have heard of.
Margaret Preston is one of the most recognisable figures in Australian modernism. She's not like many of the women artists at this time unknown or underrepresented. Hi, my name's Elle Freak and I'm the Associate Curator of Australian Art at the Art Gallery of South Australia. I'm also the co-curator of Dangerously Modern. She was an influential teacher and artist, and really she championed a whole new direction for Australian art after her pivotal early European trips.
She was a colossal figure in 20th century Australian art. But ironically, you know, when you scratch the surface, she's a bit of an enigma.
You might know Margaret Preston as a favourite of the Art Gallery gift shop. Her colourful prints of native flowers deck a thousand tea towels. Margaret herself hand-printed her greeting cards from the 1920s. When Margaret Preston began her painting career at the turn of the century, it was the heyday of a group of artists known as the Australian Impressionists. They painted outdoors, often at artists' camps. They depicted the bush, sunlight, and sheep.
Think of Hans Hyson's depiction of the gum tree or Tom Roberts' A Breakaway. These are artists who were exploring the Australian landscape in a very grand way. Very masculine images of rural labour that conservative critics at the time thought could define this nation as separate and individual.
The men got to go out and stay in artists' camps. They're wearing trousers, they're climbing over fences, they're carrying their own materials, etc. The women are wearing these incredibly tight and restrictive corsets and long skirts. They're unable to stay overnight. It's unacceptable for women to stay out overnight in camps. They have to return to proper accommodation.
Preston, at this time, like many women artists, really gravitated towards interior spaces. She spoke frequently about her preference for still life, how still life really was in opposition to a vogue for sunsets, landscapes, and ladies, the trends in Australian art at the time.
Preston began as a conservative still life painter and ended as a radical still life painter. I'm Wayne Tunnicliffe, Acting Director of Collections at the Art Gallery New South Wales and co-curator of Dangerously Modern. Preston was driven to be an artist from an early age. She really was inspired by art and visits to art galleries, and she wanted to participate in making art herself. Preston's reputation was for being feisty, undoubtedly. She valued her own perspective, and I think that's incredibly important in a time when women were often encouraged not to value their voice and not to see themselves as people who were change makers. She did.
From the very beginning, the still life was a form of quiet rebellion for Margaret. Her early works in Adelaide were of common vegetables and fruits. She painted pots and pans, silverware, lobsters, broken eggs, dead rabbits, the list goes on. But really the intention there, as she put it, was to paint them so truthfully that they could almost be used in the kitchen.
At least one of the silver tea sets that Margaret painted belonged to the family of her friend, Bessie Davidson. Margaret taught art classes to support herself, and Bessie started attending.
There was a slight difference in age. Preston was a few years older, but they were very close. At times, Preston actually lived in the Davidson home here in Adelaide.
Both Margaret and Bessie's mothers died in the space of just 2 years. And after their deaths, the two women in their 20s decided it was time to make the voyage to Europe together. And they weren't alone. South Australia was the first Australian state to allow settler women the right to vote, and the fourth place in the world. Art schools and technical colleges were flourishing in Adelaide. But middle-class women studying art wanted to break free of that Victorian past even more.
Davidson's father thought Paris was too wild and too bohemian for two young women. So the artists travelled first to Munich. They had some interesting experiences there. They were studying at the Munich Government Art School for Women. Preston in particular found the teaching there very stifling. She thought the German attitude towards women was regressive. She also spoke about the art that she viewed at the time really making her feel physically sick.
She's looking at art old and new. She decides she doesn't like the new or she reacts to it, but what happens is it stays with her and it's clearly embedded in her mind because she comes back to consider it and reconsider it. So even though the initial, I suppose, shock of the new was great, the impact was long-lasting.
And despite what Bessie Davidson's father wanted, there was no way they were not going to make a trip to Paris or North Africa. In fact, 2 years passed while Bessie and Margaret travelled overseas.
So in Paris, Preston and Davidson exhibited almost immediately. Their work still has a sense of academic realism and they're still painting in that kind of close tonal range. But eventually there would be quite a dramatic shift in the work that they produced after that time. Preston and Davidson return to Adelaide and they hold an exhibition of their work together. It included some of their paintings produced in North Africa, and they were successful. They were well reviewed here in Adelaide. Both artists had their work acquired by the Art Gallery of South Australia at that time. From all reports, they made a real impact here locally. Preston set up a school and started teaching more students and earning an income. Davidson, however, really wanted to return to Paris. So she left Adelaide in 1910, and then that's when she determined that France would be her permanent home.
Hello, I'm Sally Smart, and I'm an artist, and I'm Bessie Davidson's great niece. Margaret Preston was Bessie Davidson's teacher to start off with. They had a studio together. They had some exhibitions together. They worked together professionally. But gradually, I'm sure that you would consider them to have been lovers at some point. And there are signs of that and in the paintings as well. And that may be disputed by some people, but I feel like there was definitely a queer relationship there. As there was experimentation around sexuality for both those women. I'm not sure how that went for Margaret Preston, you know, if she married a man later, but Bessie Davidson, she met a woman, Marguerite Leroy, and she became a longtime partner of hers. Eventually, they were both entombed in the same grave together. So that's a fairly powerful sign of a very strong relationship, I think.
My name is Denise Mamocchi. I'm the Acting Head of Australian Art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales in Sydney. Margaret Preston, the idea of her first trip overseas was opening her up to new ideas. So she's back in Adelaide. She's teaching. This is the reality of her working life as well. It's not just painting, it's having to earn a living. She was becoming a little restless by this stage. She'd obviously experienced a much wider art world. And I suppose she began to consider her place within that bigger art world as well. But she's clearly building her way back up to going to Europe again. And by the time she gets to Europe or Paris in 1912, she is already aware of the type of artist that she wants to become.
This time, Margaret made the journey with a companion who she also met through her art classes. Gladys Raynell was one of the many students inspired by Margaret's teaching. She was from a well-known South Australian winemaking family, and she travelled with Margaret, who was returning to those visual ideas she'd begun to uncover on the first trip.
More and more, she's working towards modern ideas of composition and design, ideas around rhythmic construction, and her palette lightens, and you see her exploring painting with flat areas of vibrant colour.
By the summer of 1914, Margaret and Gladys Raynell needed a break. Life in London was also hard work and expensive, and their getaway was a small, impoverished village on the coast of Ireland. Across the sea, the First World War would soon break out. And they rented a little cottage and took Margaret's terrier, Little Jim, with them. This village, Bunmahan, became a special source of inspiration, not just for them, but a whole group of women they invited to join them. "You will love it," Margaret wrote on a postcard, "but expect simplicity." She marked an X where her and Gladys's cottage was, and she sent that postcard to a student in London. That student, Edith Collier, later said she'd never enjoyed anywhere like it.
And it's not an obvious choice for artists to travel to, or I have to say for anyone really to travel to in 1914. It was a remote village in Ireland, previously known for its copper mine and its fishing industry. Preston Raynell found out about it through an old guidebook and decided to travel there. I think the attraction for them was the fact that it was inexpensive. It was easy to get to from London, relatively easy. There's coastal cliffs, there's a beach, there's water. So it kind of delivered what artists were looking for when they travelled to remote areas in the 19th century. Well, really, travelling out of the city. They really began to reinvent themselves in these places. In Bunmahan, Preston Raynell and Collier, of course, are living these quite wonderful queer communal lives alongside the villagers. The villagers admired what they were doing while seeing it, of course, as being quite foreign, quite exotic, almost alien. And in a sense, it was cultural self-care, going to this location in Ireland to chill out, if you like, and actually really think about what they'd learnt in Europe in the preceding years, about the art practice they'd seen in Paris and London. Of Preston's the older artist. She's a natural teacher, and she literally is a teacher. And Edith Collier had been one of her pupils, as Gladys Rennell had been as well. Preston, as the ringleader, pushes everyone's practice. Bright colour, flattened space, decorative qualities. She's interested in these formal elements. And by formal, I mean literally colour, shape and surface on the canvases. But Edith Collier almost develops further than Preston during this time. And it's fascinating seeing the pupil overtaking the master, or in this case, if you like, the mistress.
Not far off the coast near Bunman, the British ocean liner the Lusitania was hit by a German torpedo and 1,200 people lost their lives. The government imposed a ban on painting the coastline in case it gave information to the Germans. So Margaret, Gladys and Edith decided it was easier to return to England. Before she left Europe to return home, Margaret met an Australian soldier, Bill Preston, and they got married. She was now 44 years old, and as you've heard, a very different artist to the one who'd left Australia 7 years before.
It's almost like she begins this new life in Sydney. She's entering a new decade, the 1920s, post-war period, and it's this incredible sense that she is this, not quite a new persona, but she's very aware of her public persona as an artist. So she's decided... She's now Margaret Preston. She's a Sydney artist. She has all these experiences from Europe and England, but she's very much focused on her work in Australia. She was kind of in this exceptional position in the art world where she came to be admired by, you know, conservative art lovers and modernists alike. She becomes more interested in creating an art that is in sync with an expression of the modern world. She's very inspired by her study of Japanese ukiyo-e prints. What these prints show to her is an art form that isn't about the world as we see it. It's about a subjective expression of it. It's about flattened compositions. Everything is kind of compressed into the picture plane, but it has its own logic to it, and it has a very beautiful logic to it.
When you look back, she managed to carefully align herself with the most innovative ideas, but also the kind of people that would further her cause, either financially or professionally. You know, whether it was Bessie Davidson's wealthy family or Gladys Rennell, the Rennell family, or Rupert Bunny in Paris, later in Sydney, she became very closely aligned with Sidney Ewer Smith, who was an absolute power broker in the Sydney art world. And of course, he famously devoted more space to Margaret Preston in his publications, Art in Australia and Home, than any other artist. And this very much contributed to a powerful dissemination of Margaret Preston's ideas and art.
You might know her most famous images from this time. Bold, colourful woodcuts of native wheel flowers and banksias and scenes from Sydney's harbour that she hand-painted. But from the 1920s onwards, her art began to take a different direction, one that's being grappled with today.
What's really interesting about Margaret Preston is one minute she says that all that is modern is international. And then when she returns to Australia post the First World War and settles in Sydney, she quickly reads the room and she declares all that is modern is national. She starts to produce art that appeals to a post-war nationalism.
And this is through her study of Aboriginal art forms in museums. She starts to look at adapting or appropriating, more correctly, the designs that she sees in what is an incredible cultural heritage, and she does recognise that. But she says, you know, we need to claim this for our art as well.
Margaret did claim designs, imagery, and depictions of Aboriginal people, and her appropriation, like her, was hugely influential on contemporary tastes. And she pursued this idea of a national art that took from First Nations visual culture for the rest of her career.
think in the project of Dangerously Modern is that we do get to see a slightly different side of Margaret Preston as an artist. We see her experimenting with international ideas, and we see those formative years in which she was not only an artist serving her own ideas and role, but we actually see her as a teacher and advocate for other women. And even through the words of an artist like Edith Collier, who recalled the best times of her life being spent working under Margaret Preston. I think sometimes Margaret Preston's big personality and her later work that is problematic in the story of Australian art, those stories kind of shield us from understanding the significance of what she produced during those early phases.
But while Margaret Preston enjoyed recognition at home, it was a different story for other artists, including those who she knew from her time in Europe.
The first major overview of Australian art is published in 1945, and it's written by Bernard Smith, and it's called Place, Taste and Tradition. And, you know, Smith manages to leave so many of these women out of the story. He's like a huge figure in Australian art history. He's Australia's first official art historian. And without a doubt, his opinion really held sway. And of course, it's fascinating because this book was published by Margaret Preston's friend, Sidney Ewer Smith. And when we look at the book, we realise that Preston's turn to really focus on the idea of national identity, this kind of backflip that she does, sees her being mentioned in this book almost as many times as Frederick McCubbin. This makes me think about how when Margaret Preston was in Europe and that early period in her career, she was very much part of the sisterhood. But when she comes back to Sydney and she settles, I feel like she really joins the boys' club. Meanwhile, other women continue to pursue international forms of modernism, and it's very difficult for the reception of that kind of modernism in Australia is very difficult for those women.
Bessie Davidson was in exhibitions with Bertha Morosi, Susan Ballenden, Mary Cassatt. I think she just loved being in the art world there in Paris. She's very productive. She's intellectually very interested and fitted in and had a lot of good friendships with men and women artists. But I think that relationship was a very fulfilling and very stable, and she had that freedom as well, of course, to be able to be in an intimate relationship with the woman she loved. It's so critical that we know who these women are. This is why these exhibitions like this are so important. You know, for me, it's changed. I'm still, you know, obviously very interested in Margaret Preston, and I'm also equally interested in Bessie Davidson, but all for different reasons, but also because they represent this incredible professional women artists who were finding these spaces in a very, very difficult world for women, and it still is.
You can see the paintings we've been talking about by Margaret Preston, Edith Collier and Gladys Raynell at the Dangerously Modern exhibition, which is now on at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, where you can also see a searing self-portrait by the artist Stella Bowen, who we're looking at next week.
Stella spent her whole life really looking for stillness and autonomy.
Living in this extraordinary demimonde, suddenly she's going to parties with Ezra Pound and the great poets and artists of the time.
Falling out of love is a delicate and important business, as necessary to the attainment of wisdom as the reverse experience.
That's next week on episode 2 of Dangerously Modern on The Art Show on Radio National. In today's show, you heard from curators Tracy Locke, Elle Freak and Wayne Tunnicliffe, as well as Denise Mimocki and Sally Smart. Dangerously Modern is a joint project from the art galleries of South Australia and New South Wales. The series was recorded on Kaurna and Wurundjeri lands, and it's produced by me, Rosa Ellen, with sound engineering by Melissa May and original music from Margie Jean Lewis.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.